This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the January 3rd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. That I happen to be here on the first Wednesday in January and not Joy LeClaire with Fourth Right Radio is because she and I have traded dates, and consequently, she will be here next week as well as on January 17th, her regular third Wednesday spot. Those of you who have been listening to NPR's Morning Edition Monday heard co-host Alyssa Chang interviewing correspondents Tom Bowman and Ruth Sherlock about what War Secretary James Mattis had made about the future U.S. role in Syria. She introduced the segment by asking, how is the U.S. helping shape the future of Syria? American troops and their rebel allies, she said, have nearly put an end to the Islamic State caliphate there, but that fighting, she noted, has destroyed cities and raised questions about who will control big chunks of territory, and that is where American civilians come in. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, she said, told reporters more are headed to Syria to help stabilize the country. We then heard a clip of Mattis saying, when you bring in more diplomats, they're working that initial restoration of services. They bring in the contractors. There's international money that's got to be administered. That is a diplomat's job. The military would move them around, make certain they're protected, end quote. That was from James Mattis. Chang then went on to NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, who was among the reporters questioning the secretary, and to NPR's Beirut correspondent Ruth Sherlock. And she began by asking Bowman if he had any sense of how many American civilians would be heading to Syria. He didn't. What we do know, he said, is there are roughly 2,000 or so U.S. troops that would help these American civilians. But this job for State Department workers and also these contractors will be a huge one. A lot of cities and towns have been destroyed from years of fighting, he said. And there's no estimate how long this will take, end quote. At one point in the conversation, Chang suggests that what Washington planned for Syria amounted to nation-building, which Trump pledged not to do. Bowman demurs, but here's one thing he says. Besides restoring services, the U.S. and the international community will also help train local police forces, rebuild schools, and work with local governments. So we'll have to see how this all expands. But as we've seen elsewhere in the world, this can all lead down a slippery slope to nation-building, end quote. All in all, it was a very professional interview, except one thing was missing, seriously missing. Nothing was said about what business the United States military had being in Syria in the first place, where the government of Bashar al-Assad does not want them, and where they have been supporting opponents of Assad. At what point did Congress authorize U.S. intervention in the Syrian war, which is required by the War Powers Act? The short answer is, it hasn't. Like President Obama before him, Trump is grossly abusing the authorization that Congress gave President Bush after 9/11 to use, quote, United States Armed Forces against those responsible for the attacks on September 11, 2001, and any, quote unquote, associated forces. That legislation granted the president the authority to use all, quote unquote, necessary and appropriate force against those whom he determined planned, authorized, committed, or aided the September 11th attacks or who harbored said persons or groups. That led to the invasion of Afghanistan. But that's the justification, and it has no legal standing outside of Washington. And whereas some members of Congress challenged President Obama's abuse of the 2001 authorization, no one seems to be doing so now. Ironically, one of the militias that the U.S. was indirectly supporting in Syria was the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. But a still larger question remains. Does any substantial number of Americans really care about America's wars, about what our armed forces are doing around the world and to whom? The answer would appear to be that they don't, not at least in the numbers that would lead to the kind of protest that we saw during the war in Vietnam and before, but not after, Bush launched the war in Iraq. My guest today, at 20 minutes past the hour, Professor Andrew Bacevich, is deeply troubled about that. He wonders when this country will develop a reaction to America's wars similar to what has arisen in revulsion to the sexual predators who have been driven from their pinnacles in Hollywood, Broadway, and the national media. His article about that for Tom's Dispatch, titled Still Waiting, A Harvey Weinstein Moment for America's Wars, will be the subject of our discussion. To emphasize the scope of the problem, one only has to look at Time magazine's January 1st edition that examines subjects for the new year. There is no mention anywhere in the issue of America's wars. Meanwhile, we may be seeing the seeds of yet another U.S. war bearing down on the horizon. That's one way of viewing the ongoing street protests in Iran that have been dominating our news cycles and President Trump's tweets since they began last Thursday. What you haven't heard or read about was that the day the protest began, December 28th, Israel Channel 10 reported, according to the Times of Israel, that Israel and the United States had secretly signed a far-reaching joint memorandum of understanding providing for, quote, full cooperation to deal with Iran's nuclear drive, its missile programs, and its other threatening activities, end quote. The document was signed December 12th. 2 weeks before the protests began, at the White House, and it culminated in intensive, unpublicized talks between representatives of the major Israeli and American intelligence and defense hierarchies, headed by the U.S. and Israeli national security advisors Adrian McMaster and Maya Ben-Shabbat, respectively, according to the Channel 10 newscast. Citing both American and Israeli officials, the report said the document is designed to translate into, quote, steps on the ground, position set out by Trump in his October 13th speech on Iran, in which he decertified the Iran nuclear deal. Specifically, according to the report, the U.S. and Israel agreed to set up joint teams to handle various aspects of what they perceive as the Iranian threat. One team will deal with Iranian activity in Syria and Tehran's support for Hezbollah in Lebanon. Another will deal with both diplomatic and intelligence activities designed to, quote, end quote, grapple with Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions. A third team would reportedly grapple, that's their words, with Iran's ballistic missile program and its alleged efforts to build accurate missile systems in Syria and Lebanon. And a fourth team would oversee preparation for any escalation by Iran and or Hezbollah. Quoting the Israeli officials, Channel 10 said that the meeting confirmed that the U.S. and Israel, quote, see eye to eye on the trends and processes in the region, end quote, and have now reached agreement on the strategy and policy required to deal with them. Following on the heels of his recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, this agreement makes it clear that the Trump administration is in deep collusion with Israel or subjugation to the Israeli agenda that preceded it. There is no record of any previous memo of understanding between the two countries in which they agreed to a joint undertaking against a mutual enemy that has attacked neither nation. Neither George Bush nor Obama, despite their many other failings, were ready to go to war against Iran on Israel's behalf, as de facto Bush did in deposing Saddam Hussein in Iraq. It will be interesting to see the response to this latest news, if it ever gets out, of those who are most up in arms about the Trump's campaign's alleged collusion with the Russians. The street protests in Iran have drawn the predictable comments from the prominent talking heads and think tanks on the pro-Israel-dominated Washington Beltway. Our goal should be regime change in Iran, said former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton of the Gatestone Institute, who was once praised by Israel's U.N. ambassador as, quote, the sixth man in his office. Over at the AIPAC-spawned Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former Ambassador Dennis Ross, an ubiquitous figure on Capitol Hill on the radio networks, once described as Israel lawyer by colleague Aaron David Miller, he wrote a paper headlined, Iranians are mad as hell about their foreign policy, as if Tehran's support of Syria and Hezbollah in Lebanon is what has driven the protesters into the streets. The protesters are asking why their money is spent in Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza, he tells us, and the administration should be putting out the estimates of what the Islamic Republic is actually spending. That's not the case, however. Predictably, he says, not a word about the near four decades of economic sanctions imposed on Tehran by U.S. Congress, acting on the orders of AIPAC and a stable of wealthy donors whose contributions make it the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill. Ross is for America's allies who are slower to descend to the depths of hypocrisy that prevail in Washington. The European Union, he says, and especially the French and Germans, have been largely silent so far, he complains. It will not respond to Trump's calls, but should be encouraged, nonetheless, to stand up for the human rights of those engaging in peaceful protest, and are now facing a tougher crackdown from the regime, end quote. His colleague at the Jewish Institute for International Affairs, or JINSA, the daddy of all the neocon Israeli-centered operations in Washington, Michael Makovsky, the organization's CEO, was more frank about Israel's agenda. He said, "We should recognize that maintaining Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen in their existing forms is unnatural and serves Iran's interests. There is nothing sacred about these countries' borders, which seem to have been drawn by a drunken, blindfolded cartographer," writes Makovsky. "The principal vulnerability of Iran's regional strategy," he says, "is its dependence on brutal regimes to rule lands driven by ethno-sectarian fissures. The United States," he writes, "should exploit this vulnerability by supporting those forces in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen that oppose Iran's domination and seek greater self-determination or independence from the capitals. The result could be transforming these failed states into loose confederations or new countries with more borders that more naturally conform along sectarian lines." Sectarian lines. Those are the words of JINSA CEO Michael Makovsky, formerly a West Bank settler who holds a dual Israeli and U.S. citizenship, and is a brother of David Makovsky, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a project on the Middle East peace process. Working for Israel has long been a Makovsky family affair. That last section of Michael Makovsky's article is significant because it is aligned with the argument of Israeli military strategist and journalist Oded Inan in the latter part of the last century, whose paper, A Security Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, called for Israel to do what it could to break up the Arab countries into smaller areas controlled by their respective religions or tribes. Inan's plan was based on two essential premises. This is essentially what has happened in Iraq, Syria, and Libya. The Inan plan in action with the U.S. doing the heavy lifting. The mapmakers, who Makovsky dismissed as drunk and blindfolded, include Winston Churchill and happen to be from the same group of Englishmen responsible for the Balfour Declaration. That was a document which a century ago, when it wasn't theirs to give, the British handed Palestine over to a small group of European Jews who called themselves Zionists, who believed that they and their co-religionists had more of a right to live in there than the country's indigenous inhabitants. It was, from the British perspective, a proper reward from what they perceived was the Zionist role in pressuring the U.S. to enter World War I when it did, thus assuring a victory over the Kaiser. Most of you have never heard of JINSA and Colin Powell's statement to his biographer that it was responsible for the war in Iraq, but it never got much play. That's the way they wanted it. Why should the public know that 57 former generals, admirals, police chiefs, and sheriffs are on its advisory board, along with former Senator Joe Lieberman and the ubiquitous John Bolton? Why would it want the public to know about the generals and admirals' trip to Israel it hosts annually, in which recently retired American generals and admirals are invited to visit Israel with JINSA to meet the top echelon of the Israeli military and political leadership, which ensures that the American delegation is well briefed on the security concerns of Israel, as well as the key role Israel plays as a friend and ally of the U.S.? One would think this would require JINSA to register as a foreign agent, but we learned long ago, as did President Kennedy and his brother Robert, who tried to do it and failed, and more recently Grant Smith of the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, that organizations working for the benefit of Israel are de facto, but not de jure, immune from having to register as foreign agents, even though that is clearly what they are. Then there is JINSA's Homeland Security Program, created in cooperation with the Israel National Police, the Israel Ministry of Internal Security, and the Israel Security Agency, Shin Bet, that's our FBI, to support and strengthen American law enforcement counterterrorism practices. According to the JINSA site, the program takes delegations of senior law enforcement executives to Israel to study methods and observe techniques used in preventing and reacting to acts of terrorism, and sponsors conferences within the United States, bringing Israeli experts before much larger groups of law enforcement leaders. Since the primary role of Israeli law enforcement agency is to suppress Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation, they are hardly a guide to what U.S. police need, where the instances of having to respond to what Israelis define as acts of terror are almost non-existent. Former members of the JINSA board have included Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Perle. When Trump, his vice president, Mike Pence, and U.N. ambassador tweet about respecting the human rights of Iranians, it is well to revisit an expose of Washington's criterion for use of the term published in Politico last May 31st. 3 months into his tenure as Secretary of State, said the article, Rex Tillerson alarmed veteran diplomats with remarks that sounded like a potential shift in American foreign policy. The U.S., he said, should be careful not to let values like human rights create obstacles to the pursuit of its interests. The comment at a gathering of State Department employees provoked an outcry among former U.S. officials and human rights activists who feared America was abandoning a vital mission. That's their words. 2 weeks later, a top Tillerson advisor wrote up a short tutorial in the form of a confidential memo to his boss, recapping the debate over how far to emphasize human rights, democracy promotion, and liberal values in American foreign policy. The May 17th memo advises Washington to use human rights as a club against its adversaries like Iran, China, and North Korea, while giving a pass to repressive allies like the Philippines, Egypt, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. Allies should be treated differently and better than adversaries, it says. Otherwise, we end up with more adversaries and fewer allies. And that's a memo written by Tillerson's influential policy aide, Brian Hook. Finally, a decade ago, retired four-star General Wesley Clark, a former commander of NATO, appeared on Democracy Now! And said that about 10 days after 9/11, he learned that the Pentagon was already making plans for a completely unjustified invasion of Iraq, and that he was shown a memo by a former colleague at the Pentagon that contained a neocon plan to, quote, take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq, and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran, end quote. If you haven't looked at a map lately, I'll save you the trouble. 5 of the first 6 have been effectively dismembered, with hundreds of thousands dead and as many made homeless or into refugees. Were it not for the presence of Hezbollah with its fighting skills, Lebanon would have been added to the list. The rest are still at war 10 years later, and apparently Iran is now in their crosshairs. This is Jeff Blankford, and thank you for listening.